I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Dan O'Brien has just published a collection of poetry, New Life. It is a collection of poems written by O'Brien about the journalist Paul Watson. His first collection, published 2 years ago, War Reporter, received the 2013 Fenton Aldabur Prize and was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best First Collection in the United Kingdom. The friendship and, to a certain extent, collaboration with Watson has thus far yielded two collections of poetry, a prize-winning play, The Body of an American, as well as an opera. Both Dan O'Brien and Paul Watson join me now. I'll get them to discuss the connection shared by these two men and the poems that Dan has written and the process to which he came to them. Paul Watson is an award-winning journalist who received the Pulitzer Prize for Spot News Photography in 1994 for his photograph of Sergeant William Cleveland's body being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. He has received many awards for his reporting in war zones across the world. New Life features poems that follow Mr. Watson through some of his reporting of the Arab Spring, such as Syria, Libya, and Egypt. He resigned this past summer from the Toronto Star after many years at the paper over differences had over reporting he had done on the Franklin expeditions. The website for more is at arcticstarcreativity.com. Dan O'Brien is a 2015 Guggenheim Fellow in Drama and Performance Art. The Body of an American received the Horton Foote Prize for Outstanding New American Play, the Edward M. Kennedy Prize for Drama, and the Penn Center USA Award for Drama. Dan's website is at danobrien.org. New Life is published by CB Editions. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Los Angeles today, Dan O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Joe, for having us on.
You're very welcome. And in Toronto, Paul Watson. Mr. Watson, good morning.
Good morning, and ditto. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Paul, I'd like to begin with some sort of current affairs questions, and we'll talk about the collection shortly, Dan. When you resigned, Paul, from the Toronto Star this past July, it was a rather public break. You've spoken to Jesse Brown at Canada Lounge about this a couple of times at least, and subsequently your work has, that you've been doing on the Franklin expedition, that's been published at BuzzFeed. This past Monday, your old school chum Stephen Harper was defeated in the general election. What does that mean for the reporting that you've done on the Franklin story?
The thing that I wanted most to report was not simply the fact that an ally of the government, a man named John Geiger, who's the head of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society, had bent the truth, to put it politely, concerning his role in the discovery of HMS Erebus, which was the flagship of Sir John Franklin during his ill-fated 1845 expedition, in which all 129 men were lost. On the surface, that's what the story was about. But the deeper story I wanted to tell, and I think I succeeded, was in showing the bizarre lengths that the Harper government would go to manipulate public opinion by using history as propaganda. Now, one of the reasons I came to Toronto was to attend the graduation at my old high school, which Stephen Harper also attended. We were friends there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw my old history teacher, and I put it to him, and, he's a wise man, the sort of teacher that changes lives and certainly changed ours because of his passion for history. And I put it to him, he read the story and got the point of it. And I said, if we had done that in your class, what would you have said to us? And I can tell you, he's not happy with it. History is important. And you can gag scientists and you can do all sorts of other things, but those people can fight back. They can get their message out. But when you start manipulating history for political purposes, you're into the danger zone. And I think that a lot of Canadians got that. I think that they saw just how bizarre this government had become.
And the Toronto Star's reputation took a hit over this, didn't it?
Well, I think it certainly should have, because it's clear to me that they were trying to protect a friend. John Geiger's a former journalist who has a lot of friends in this business. And one of the principal problems with this country, of which the Harper government was only a symptom, is this very tight, cliquish group of people who have influence in various areas. They have influence in the arts, they have influence in business, they have influence in politics and the media. And it's a comfortable, cozy little group. And the Star made a huge mistake, in my mind, at a time when the traditional media is fighting for its survival. Technology doesn't save you if you don't have trust with your readership. And I think the Toronto Star clearly lost trust with those who were paying attention. And I'll grant there aren't a lot of people. Old habits are hard to break. The Toronto Star is a big brand, so people tend to trust what they've had for a long time. But I can assure you from personal experience, if they're protecting friends in this case, you don't know what they're not telling you in many other cases. And if you can't have the simple bond of trust that your news source is telling you all that you need to know and not hiding anything, I think you need to find a new news source.
When all this happened in the summer, I remember you went on with Jesse Brown talking about this and the sort, and just as soon as the story broke, there were a lot of people on social media attacking you, impugning you personally, your motives, your work, even your mental state in some instances. When all this happened, I remember thinking of Dan's work and Dan's writing about you. And the connection that you both have, because it explained a lot of who you are.
Well, you know, I'm glad you said that, because another symptom to me of this problem is, you know, especially in Canada, I see it. You have journalists who act like they know it all simply because they're journalists. So if the narrative is that I'm crazy and that I'm a personnel problem, as the Toronto Star put it, and all sorts of other things which simply do not add up if you look at basic facts. If you look at my reputation, if you look at Dan's work and other bits of evidence that are freely available, you would quickly conclude that the Toronto Star was doing what journalists constantly attack corporations and governments for doing, and that is spinning and lying, and then trying to discredit the messenger. The simple truth in what happened was I was covering a story of significant public interest. The Star tried to kill it, and that leaves a journalist no choice. I can't go back to my little cubicle and keep my nose at the grindstone if I'm working for people who won't tell the truth to the public. So I had to quit. That's a very simple story, and yet I had journalists actually say to me, "No one's going to believe you, because no one would believe you would give up a good income over a story like this." I continue to be shocked at hearing that. And I didn't hear it just from one. I heard it from several. The point being that I must be crazy because I quit because I couldn't stand to have my employers suppress the truth.
And so, Dan, throughout all of this, just the ethics and the integrity that Paul has shown, that he's spoken out about, was that sort of stuff what initially drew you to him years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not surprised at all by the progression or the trajectory of the story. This is the Paul I've come to know. We've been working together. I've been writing about him since 2007, 2008. I'm very aware that to some degree I've created a character of Paul Watson, but I have tried to use his writing, his experience, his memories, things he shared with me about his life and his journalism as much as I can in the writing. So I feel like I know him pretty well. And I wasn't surprised at all. I think, you know, it's somewhat it's a cliche for journalists as well as for artists that this sort of single-minded pursuit of the truth is our aim, is our goal. But that's something that unites the both of us. And I don't think the truth is worth much if it just makes everyone happy. Do you know what I mean? The truth that people don't want to discuss, even in terms of Paul's photography, even in terms of his Pulitzer Prize-winning picture, that photograph was something that people needed to see for lots of reasons. and it came at a great cost to Paul, but to many other people.
Yeah.
But it still needed to be seen. So yeah, that's at the heart of what's drawn me to Paul as a journalist and as an artist too. I think of him as an artist in many ways.
When we first spoke about that first collection, Dan, War Reporter, a couple of years ago now, I asked you about the nature of your relationship. I think I did ask you, but I mean, I've forgotten already, and I'm sure people listening to us have forgotten. But how would you describe it for people who ask about the two of you? I mean, it is a friendship. Is it a collaboration?
I've described it as a peculiar collaboration in the sense that, you know, Paul has shared with me so much material conversationally, but also in terms of his writing. You know, really, as far as I can tell, given me kind of a blank check to write about his life. That said, he never reads what I write. You know, I don't send him the poems to say, what do you think of this, and what would you change, or he's never seen the play for reasons that I completely understand, that maybe he could, if he wanted to, he could explain a little differently, but I've always assumed that it's just kind of, you know, it'd be too disturbing to revisit some of the war zones he's been to, and so it's peculiar in that sense. So it feels like a collaboration because I couldn't be writing what I'm writing, of course, without him, without his life, without his stories, without his trust. And at the same time, you know, he does leave my side of the writing up to me.
So Paul, where does this trust come from then in Dan?
You know, it's a strange thing. I just looked again at my email. I have 3,300 unopened emails over, you know, however many years I've had this account. That's simply to say that I don't often answer strangers' emails.
Mm-hmm.
But I did in Dan's case, and I can't really explain why. But I will say this. You know, if you see enough people killed in horrible ways over your lifetime, I think it's natural to become superstitious. And, you know, I will admit, I say constantly, I don't believe in God, but I believe in ghosts. And I just had a sense that I was supposed to talk to Dan, so I did, and I don't regret it. I don't read what he writes, but I have been exposed to his audiences, and I can tell from just looking in their eyes, not to mention what they say by way of questions and discussion, that he is expressing a truth that I failed to. And all that I care about is the truth. That sounds you know, far more noble than it should be, because I don't pretend to be noble. But I really do think that our world is in big trouble if we don't start shaming spin artists, call them what they are, propagandists, and get past all the marketing and the nonsense and just start being honest with each other and telling the truth. So that's what I believed I was meant to do. And it could be, you know, I could be talking to myself, or I could be doing what I think I'm doing, which is answering to the call of the people who aren't here to tell the truth. And that's just a sense I have in my heart, that there are people who we lost, and if I can do anything to try to overcome the guilt that I feel, it is just to tell the truth. Just cut the BS. And whenever you get a chance, tell the truth.
There's a line in one of the poems, Paul, that Dan's written in this new collection, New Life, where I guess you told him at one point that if you are ever held hostage or beheaded or something like that in the course of your work, that the media should talk to Dan because he knows you quite well, that he can speak for you.
Well, I don't remember saying that. But I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did because I can tell you, when I was getting roughed up by the Toronto Star, and it hasn't completely ended, by the way,
mm-hmm.
that's exactly the thought I had. I thought, here are people writing about me who don't have the first idea who I am. You know, I don't spend a lot of time talking to journalists because I don't particularly like them. For some of the reasons I've spelled out.
Right.
So the person who truly does know how I think, apart from my wife, is Dan O'Brien. But of course, no journalist would think to talk to him. You know, instead they talk to the people who are attacking me, which makes absolutely no sense.
Paul, I asked Dan a couple years ago when he appeared on the program for the first time whether he was sort of owned by you now, just as you've been owned by that image of that body in Somalia. Do you think that places an unfair burden on Dan?
I don't know. This is not meant as a negative sentiment, mm-hmm. but you know, we come, we go. I don't put all that much importance in it. So if I am a burden, I certainly don't want to be. But I don't think that it has that weight of importance, frankly. You know, put the truth out there, let people do what they will with it, ignore it or grab it and embrace it, but otherwise just live your life.
You know, and I'll say, I don't remember exactly how I answered that question 2 years ago, but other people have asked me that too, and I think, you know, the answer is, it's been the greatest opportunity of my life to write about Paul, to engage with that photograph, for instance, you know, that photograph in many ways, and the sense of a haunting that Paul feels, and anyone would feel from that sort of experience, to be able to engage with that and to try to find meaning in an exploration, an artistic exploration of the truth, has truly been the greatest opportunity artistically, but also just personally and psychologically. So, you know, there have been, and I think to some degree working with Paul, I've tried to sort of gently open up that possibility that, you know, when he heard a voice say, if you do this, if you take this picture, I'll own you forever. You know, trying to sort of tease out the possibility that being owned in some fashion isn't necessarily an entirely negative thing, you know, that it just means that you have a certain responsibility to the truth moving forward, that you owe it to your experience, that you owe it to other people who have had experiences like this to you know, to witness their trauma, and again, to try to make art or meaning of it, which I think is always going to be, you know, a constructive, you know, truth-telling, truth-exploring experience.
And Dan, you know, pardon me, Paul. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I learned something very important from my relationship with Dan, which is that poetry is much better at telling the truth than journalism, than straight prose.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dan can explain that better than I can, but I know it from the audience reaction to his work. The things that I tried to say through prose and pictures, he captures in a much stronger, more compelling truth.
But, you know, I have to say, and I've said this to Paul in public, too, before, that I think one reason our peculiar collaboration works so well is because I feel kind of the reverse. Do you know what I mean? I respect and value what playwrights and poets do, but, you know, I realize that I couldn't be writing what I'm writing without somebody who's actually gathering the facts, who's actually engaging with life and experience in a way that a lot of poets, for example, have trouble doing. And that was at the heart of the collaboration when it began years ago. I was fascinated by how similar I felt to Paul psychologically in certain ways, but then, of course, how different my lifestyle was, how different certain aspects of my psychology is, and thinking that there was some connection, some overlap there that could be real, that could create work that was greater than what I normally would do, and maybe in some ways greater than what, you know, journalism can do on its own. So it's really the collaboration that's most fascinating and rewarding to me.
You and I, Dan, have talked about Paul's meaning in your life and sort of the stuff that you've had to work through because of your what's happened in your family and the sort. This last 7, 8, 10 years or however long it's been that you guys have known each other, have you grown personally, do you think, because of this friendship that you've had with Paul Watson?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still kind of, you know, because I'm still writing about him. New life is going to be developed into a new play, which is part of my Guggenheim Fellowship this year. So, you know, I'm still trying to understand what his work and his life means to me in my life. I mean, I think in some obvious ways it's made me a more socially engaged writer. I think because of a fairly, domestically traumatic childhood, I wrote about very personal, domestic, intimate things, often about my childhood. And getting to know Paul and writing about him has certainly drawn out my own work in general and helped me to write about things that aren't necessarily about Paul, but are more socially engaged, for lack of a better term. And I also felt like years ago when I first started working with him, I wanted to, when I was younger, I used writing as an escape from life in many ways. It helped me work out things I was feeling, but it was still an escape from reality. And I wanted to, 7 or 8 years ago, I wanted to use my writing as a way to engage more with other people, to collaborate more with other people, to think of the product of my work as secondary to the relationships that I could forge with other people, meaningful relationships. So that's something that I think has changed. It's always continuing to change, but it's something that's changed from working with Paul, for sure. And he's taught me so much about courage in terms of your work, not just in terms of making people unhappy at times, if hearing the truth is going to make them unhappy, but physical courage, putting yourself to some degree out of your comfort zones in order to pursue a meaningful story. I do, whether this is somewhat embarrassing to say in front of him, but I do try to emulate him in some small ways.
Dan, did you guys hit it off right away? I mean, was there, I guess it was email where you guys first met, is that right?
I think we did. I mean, somewhat interestingly, at least to me, we took a while to we spent maybe 2 years just kind of writing emails to each other. Sometimes, many emails, sometimes I'm sure months and months would go past. And then in 2010, we met up for the first time. We hadn't even spoken on the phone. We met face-to-face for about a week in Uluhaktok, which is in the Northwest Territories, where Paul was doing some stories. I feel like we've always hit it off. I think there's one poem in the new collection, which is a version of the one argument we've had, which was when we were preparing for our Hollywood TV pitch.
Yeah.
There's a sort of a structural vein through New Life about how we had a certain dream that is still a possibility to sell a cable drama about Western reporters covering Syria. And, I think of it as a kind of comic poem because it's not a real fight. It was all about, I think, our nerves. It's sort of the irony of a war reporter. It would make sense for a poet to be nervous to pitch a TV show, to executives at HBO. But
right.
There's a certain irony of somebody like Paul being nervous. And that's really the only thing that I can think of where we've had any sort of disagreement. So unless Paul is hiding his intense hatred of me, I think we've hit it off pretty well.
So there isn't a hidden hatred, is there, Paul?
No, that was a very important moment. I never told Dan this. But, one of the things that happens to you when, at least in my case, when you're exposed to constant trauma of war, is that this whatever switch that's in the human mind that allows you to filter that out so that you can function and still trust people broke in my mind. So I really cannot deal with conflict with people, which is one of the reasons I avoid people as much as I can. And Dan was the last person on this planet I wanted to have a conflict with. So it was that was actually a very traumatizing thing for me. I really felt it in my heart. I thought, now I've ruined this. And fortunately, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. That was really a difficult time.
No, I think it was an interesting, and I hope it's an interesting poem. It's really almost a dialogue. It comes near the end of the book because it was right before we were going to do our big, week of pitching to all these different executives. And I hope it's somewhat comic, but that it's also kind of pointed too. Again, because it's this idea that somebody like Paul is trying to transmute his life into art, but he's also trying to figure out how, and I am too, trying to figure out how to bring it into a marketplace. And how to do that and feel ethically and morally okay about that, to feel. And so I think it's a kind of a fascinating, and of course the anxiety that the character of the poet, the book is always referring to the poet and the war reporter, the sort of, to some degree, archetypal difference in temperament, and what does it mean for a poet to go to Hollywood? What is that potential bargain all about? I think, of course, yes, at the time I was feeling like Paul too, like, oh my God, we're having a have an argument. What is this? What's going to happen? We'd known each other. At that point, we'd known each other like, you know, 5 or 6 years. But by the end of it, it felt great, as is often the case, because I think we just felt even a bit, you know, safer with each other.
So, Paul, has this friendship, has this yielded for you some sort of catharsis because you've been able to tell him things that you wouldn't otherwise have told other people, perhaps?
It's not a catharsis in the sense that I feel any more pure or unburdened than I have from the start. But I do have a sense that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. For whatever reason, that I'm fulfilling a mission that I'm supposed to fulfill. And that's, you know, I don't break out a sweat or anything. I simply, Dan asks me questions, and we chat, and then he does what he does. The longer-term impact, to be serious about this, is being around someone who's as good as his art as Dan is at his. You are lured into this false sense that it's easy. And that, hey, shit, I could do that too. So now I'm a closet playwright poet. I was even toying, I woke up the other day and thought, my God, you just saved yourself from a huge embarrassment. I was actually toying with the idea of applying to a Master of Fine Arts program to see if I could become a playwright and a poet.
See, I still think you should do that. I think that would be great. I mean, I would say, you know, part of what's been interesting to me is that I feel... I mean, I'm a million miles away from being a journalist, but I'm having trouble writing things that aren't close to really docudrama lately, because the idea of just kind of making something up on my own just doesn't really do it for me anymore. And so it's kind of interesting to me how I think Paul and I have both kind of moved a bit towards each other's genres, you know.
Yeah.
Even in terms of Paul writing, you know, he's writing nonfiction books right now. And, you know, there's been some movement. And I think it makes more sense why working with Paul would affect me. But it's been interesting to see why, you know, Paul's potentially become a little bit more interested in quote-unquote creative writing.
Just imagine, Paul, the letter that a Guggenheim fellow and an award-winning playwright would how far that'd go at an MFA program, don't you think?
Right, but then I realized the problem would be you have to write. And you know, anyone who's been through these programs will tell you they're brutal.
Yeah.
You know, your writing is just shredded. And, you know, I may not have the temperament for that.
Now, Paul, the poems in this new collection, New Life, as well as the previous one, War Reporter, not all of them, but most of them, I should say, articulate the ugliness of war and the upheaval that can happen now and into the future for the people involved, whether they're in combat, whether they're citizens, whether they're observers like you are. And that's the sense that we get from Dan's work. On the other side, though, there can be great beauty amid such horrible situations. And was that something that you, as part of, say, your mission, as part of service, you wanted people to know about through Dan's work?
Yes, that's because that's just an integral part to me of the attraction. I didn't like, after a while, the brutality of it. At first I did. It was a rush. But after a while, I didn't. What drew me back to it was how human beings are reduced to almost their pure goodness and their pure evil in those places. So you'll see both. And to see the courage of ordinary people, day in and day out, you know, we're now seeing it through some of the reporting on Syrian and other refugees fleeing conflicts into Europe. It's extraordinary the courage of a family that have to tell their children every day, get up, we have to walk again. And when they cry at night and say, I'm hungry and I need a blanket, and they don't have one, and they're sleeping in the forest, and winter's coming, but they keep going because that's all they have. And everything else sort of becomes unimportant next to that. I can't follow regular news when that's in front of me, because that's all I care about. That's all that matters.
And Dan, he must describe it to you so viscerally, because you've never been in combat, you've never been in a war zone. that you're able to transpose that into your work so vividly and so clearly for the reader.
Yeah, a lot of what I feel like I'm doing is just trying to mine the language that Paul either uses in conversation or that he uses in his own writing. So a lot of it really at times is his own language that I've maybe reworked or adapted. Then there's, I think, just a certain amount of understanding psychological trauma. You know, I do feel like I've had personal experience of trauma, even if it's not in a war zone and is not nearly as extreme as an experience of trauma. But that's always been central to my work. So there's a certain amount of that. And then I think the last ingredient that is most meaningful to me and most moral, maybe, as an endeavor, is trying to imagine even more deeply what Paul may have experienced or what the people that Paul is writing about may have experienced. And so that's where I allow myself a certain amount of poetic license, I think, with some of these stories and characters. And, you know, I'm sure sometimes I overshoot the mark, and if Paul did read these poems, he could, you know, I'm sure he could point out elements that seem like I'm faking it or something. But the attempt to have empathy and put myself in his place and put myself in the place of people that he's trying to understand and tell their story, I think is central to what's meaningful about, what I hope is meaningful about the poems and the plays.
And that, you know, that after all is what art captures. It's the universality of the human condition. The trap that I fell into time and time again in writing from abroad for an audience in the United States or in Canada was that you're writing about something that then seems like it's distant and otherworldly, so that people can say, well, isn't that terrible, but that's what happens over there. But that's not the point. The truth is, it's within all of us. And under the right or wrong circumstances, depending how you look at it, we're all murderers. We are all capable of the most horrific atrocities. The only reason we're not doing it, you know, those of us in Canada, the United States, most of us at the moment, is that the conditions aren't there for people to manipulate us to get to that point. But I can assure you, for instance, that the people of Aleppo, Syria, you know, that's an ancient civilization. These are mainly middle-class, well-educated people who are now living the nightmare on Earth that so many other civilizations have gone through. And we're not special. And the same thing can happen to us. And it's Dan's art that captures that for me.
There are a number of...
There's also just something theatrical in the whole collaboration, in the sense that, you know, coming to Paul's work first as a dramatist, you know, it was very central to try to wear the mask of other people, to wear the mask of Paul Watson, to wear the mask of people he's written about in Aleppo, Syria. You know, so the idea was, on some deep level, to identify as closely as I could with who he's writing about, and to hope that there's some value in that.
There are a number of poems in this book that discuss combat sex. Do you get asked that a lot, about that a lot, Dan?
About the combat?
Yeah.
You know, I think it was something that came up as we were putting together the pitch, and I found it interesting as a concept. The idea being, you know, like during the Blitz in World War II, that... Or during a blackout in a major city, there 9 months later, lots of babies are born. You know, this idea that heightened dangerous experience often leads to intense sexual romantic encounters. So that was interesting on just on a basic level, because all of what Paul writes about is about these heightened situations that bring human characteristics into sharp relief. But it was also interesting to me in terms of trying to transmute. Reality for Hollywood, reality for, something that could still be meaningful and true art while still trying to negotiate with the idea of what does the marketplace want? What does Hollywood want? What does Western media want?
And did you find that process of going to Hollywood, Paul, because Dan's already talked about what an odd experience that was for him. For you, that must have been something out of this world almost.
Well, imagine this. You're in some executive's office, I think it was HBO or one of the big ones, with, three pretty powerful executives sitting in front of you, and you break down sobbing as you're trying to explain to them the world that you're offering in a pilot. I've wept in public before, so it's not a big deal for me. But to weep in front of Hollywood executives is a particularly interesting experience.
And it was, I told Paul before we even started this experience that I was going to be recording these conversations. So I should have said a lot of the poems and the playwriting also come from audio recordings of our conversations, our experience. So I knew on some level that I was interested in some ways, a theater of this. Uh-huh. A pitch happens in a room, but it still is a performance for your kids that is some version of any form of storytelling where you're trying to get somebody to care. You just happen in Hollywood or, in the business setting, you're trying to get somebody to also pay for it. But that's true of most storytelling as well. And so I was really fascinated by how, not just Paul, but myself, how we were going to make sense of that. And, and I'm interested, I'm always interested, in not just in what Paul says or what I might be able to write, but sort of the rough edges, the places where things don't really work in terms of maybe creatively, but also in terms of conversation and experience. So I found the whole experience of pitching, of creating a TV pitch, which took months, and then, spending about a week or so, 10 days pitching the show, I found it really fascinating on its own terms.
I'll admit to this frustration, which is also interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I've already said that journalism, in my mind, fails to convey the truthful reality of war. It just seems two-dimensional when it comes through your TV set or on your news pages. When I went into those meetings with Hollywood people, I thought, well, geez, you're already producing a program, for instance, about a science teacher who cooks meth or, mm-hmm. Some Fox News TV guy, the obvious examples. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, if you think that's interesting, where do you hear this? But they just, in every instance, as I remember it, they sort of looked at it like, well, yeah, that's interesting, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were ultimately told in the end, indirectly, that no one gives a flying F about journalists, especially not journalists in war. Now, I don't know what market research there is to back that up, but that seems to be the consensus. And, once again, I don't get it, because it's an incredibly compelling world, of which Combat 6 is only one part.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly did hear this sort of cliche or truism, I don't know if it is true, but that it's difficult to sell TV shows or movies about journalists. But I think looking back on the pitching process, it also strikes me as kind of very meaningful that in some ways we just didn't sell out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If we had more combat sex and bang bang, as Paul says in some of the poems, maybe we would have sold it. There's that term high concept. That it wasn't high concept. The idea being, I don't know, that they're journalists who are also vampires, something that's really easy to market and to catch on to, and anybody could find it at least diverting, and that we were perhaps keeping it too substantial. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that, too. Maybe it just wasn't a, quote, good enough pitch, but, we were thinking of it closer to something like The Wire, which is, of course, a masterpiece,
right.
But was... did not give great ratings when it was on. It took years and years to build up the momentum in terms of its appreciation. Looking back on it, I do wonder if, we had brought in another producer who was really crass and had a realistic word, like sort of a P.T. Barnum instinct for showbiz, maybe we would have sold it, but maybe we wouldn't have been able to live with that, that alteration of our ideals.
There's a beautiful poem near the end of the book, Dan, where you talk about Paul visiting his mother, who is, I guess, in a hospital, you subsequently told another interviewer, at, I believe it's Michigan Quarterly Review, about, because they asked you about that poem, and you say writing the poem for you was just as Paul was sort of learning to let go of his mom, learning to let go of writing about Paul. You're not really serious about that, are you?
Well, I mean, at first I should say, because Paul probably doesn't even know I wrote this poem. It was a very short poem. I hope it's moving. It was moving to me.
It was, yeah.
Paul, I think, emailed to me, you know, emailed me about visiting his mother, I think in a nursing home. But Paul, you could probably clarify. And it's very simple. It doesn't go into his, but it's, yeah, it is about sort of, about letting go of somebody that you that you care about. And, you know, part of the structure of new life is that question of what's next? You know, what's next for me? What's next for Paul? I mean, there are poems that, that, you know, suggest the trajectory that Paul has had recently with the Toronto Star, and moving on to maybe either a different form of writing,
yeah,
or a different type of journalism, but perhaps leaving war reporting behind for good. So, you know, part of it was about, on many levels, sort of, what's next? You know, what comes after war? What comes after trauma? You know, so on some level, yeah, I have spent a while thinking, you know, how many years can I bug Paul Watson for material? So that's part of it. And I think, you know, the collection does try to capture what I think is probably a natural, you know, the collaboration probably has to end one day. Again, I am now trying to turn new life into a play, which could be several years now of continuing to work with Paul, which I'm extremely happy about. So, you know, I think it could be a gradual parting of creative ways. And who knows, maybe in 5 years we'll come back and work on some. We definitely talk about other projects that are more removed from Paul's life in terms of things we could collaborate on. So, you know, I think there's always a very, very good chance of that.
I pray, I don't even believe in God, but I still pray that I can work with Dan O'Brien for as long as Dan O'Brien is with us.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just thinking about these two books of poetry already, because I haven't seen the play, I haven't seen the opera, it's a collaboration that means so much to the reader, I think. You probably don't know that, Paul, because you haven't read the poems, but I mean, there's something greatly meaningful about the work that you both have created here.
Well, you see, I've heard this from other people, and I haven't read it. I haven't read the poem that you're speaking about now, but I know that, you know, I keep talking about the truth. I actually just went and saw my mother in the nursing home today, and she hadn't seen me for months.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she has dementia, so anyone who's gone through this, and there are, you know, many of your listeners will have, you immediately realize, I did, that you can sort of see her trying to figure out, who is this man sitting in front of me? I think I know him, but I'm not sure. And there's sort of moments where she's sort of looking for clues, and she might notice, you know, I have one hand, for instance. She spends a lot of time looking at the fact that I'm missing one hand, and you know that somewhere deep in there it's registering, but she's not quite certain, and it upsets her that she can't put her finger on the truth. And when you live through that experience, you know on a much deeper level that what we easily call the truth every day. Well, I read the truth in my newspaper, or my friend told me the truth over lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that simple. The truth is very, very hard to grasp. And you know, that's why I want to keep working with Dan, because he gets me closer to it.
Paul, your mother's maiden name, is that Planta?
That's right, and isn't that weird?
Yeah. Your sister emailed me about, 8 years ago, because I guess she was with your mom and they were trying to look up relatives. And I guess they found me online. And they wondered if we were related. Now, my parents are Filipino, so we're not related. But there were Plantas here in British Columbia. I guess they lived in Nanaimo 100 years ago. They came from Australia, I think. Is that right?
That That part I don't know. The I don't think it was Australia, but I think one of them ended up there.
Yeah, I guess it was Scotland then.
That's right.
Yeah, there was a planta that ended up in the Senate here in Canada.
Well, he's definitely my relative. He ended up in a federal prison.
yeah, that's right. Yeah. A lot's changed, hasn't it, Paul, in this country?
Right. And look, if you follow it back far enough, you remember that Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they have the theory that Christ was taken down from the cross before he died and survived and ended up, his bloodline ended up as the Plantagenet kings.
Uh-huh.
If you go down the list at the back of that book, Planta is one of the derivations of the bloodline. So quite possibly we're both related to Jesus Christ.
There you go.
That's great.
There you go.
It's written down. I'm kidding, but it is written down.
Something tells me the O'Briens are not related to Jesus Christ. Although we went to church a lot. That's for sure.
Dan, how often do you guys see one another?
You know, we haven't seen each other in a while. I think since this Hollywood pitch, which was 2 years ago, I keep threatening to come visit Paul, and I'm going to soon, especially because of this new play. And I was we were sort of lining up generally, but we're going to make it happen. Paul coming to Los Angeles for a workshop of the new play, and he's definitely coming to see the first play I wrote is going to have an off-Broadway production next winter. So he's going to come and be part of some audience, you know, talkbacks and that sort of thing in February in New York, as well as January in Connecticut. It opens in Hartford, and then it moves to the Cherry Lane Theater in New York. So I'll see that. Actually, Paul, I saw you last winter in Philadelphia because the play was done at the Wilma Theater, and
that's
Paul
right.
came out to talk to the audience at a few events.
I knew I was going to talk to Dan ever since I got this book about a month or so ago, but having you, Paul, as part of this conversation, came together less than 24 hours ago, so it didn't give me enough time to get nervous, because I really, now that I think about it, feel like I'm intruding on something special between the two of you, what with this connection that you both have personally and through this powerful work that this friendship has yielded. Paul, this is something I'll not soon forget, and Dan, thanks for this. Continued good luck with the book.
Well, thank you. And it's not, you know, from my perspective, it's not an intrusion at all. It's a real gift to be able to have somebody help us try to get, you know, the work out and get the stories out that I think are, I hope, are so meaningful. So thank you.
It's been a privilege.
And look, I'm just gratified that people care. So it's not. I don't see it as an intrusion at all. If people are interested enough to read and to listen, I feel like, please dig as deeply as you want to dig. If you can find more to learn from, keep going.
The websites for more, arcticstarcreativity.com and danobryan.org. The book is called New Life. It's published by CB Editions. Paul Watson joined me on the line from Toronto, while Dan O'Brien was on the line from Los Angeles. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.